Chaplain Pollock, we are vitally interested in a sound national security. During our observance of National Security Week, I have found that a number of questions have been raised concerning the program of security. We are convinced that military preparedness is indispensable to the preserving of peace and prosperity here in the United States as well as in the rest of the world. I believe you have the answers to some of these objections which I have been meeting, and I feel it would benefit our citizens to hear them.
Well, thank you sincerely, Captain Parisi. I am not a prophet, and I don't know how to read a crystal ball, but as one American to another, I am willing to voice some opinions for whatever they are worth. Let's talk over some of the problems that have come up concerning national defense. Maybe we can reach some satisfactory conclusions.
A splendid suggestion. But before we go into that, perhaps I should explain why we are here. We are representing the 500 reserve officers of Kalamazoo County who participated in World War II and who are retaining their commissions in the belief that by so doing, they will contribute to peace. We are among more than 500,000 such officers in the United States who in their own communities tonight are discussing the same subject. What is the best insurance for national security?
You might add that the reserve officers of the nation, as in our community, are in no sense militarists. They are civilians now engaged in every calling and in every walk of life.
That's correct, and there are no exceptions. Our governor is a reserve officer. So is the postman who brings my mail every morning. So is the pastor of my church and the teacher of our high school children and my family doctor.
You speak truly. There are no class or economic distinctions in the ranks of our citizen soldiers. It includes them all.
That's right. Now, Chaplain Pollock, in talking this week about national security among my neighbors and business associates, I have been asked some rather stiff questions. What we want is a formula to protect our nation and its traditional freedoms. We advocate in the Reserve Officers Association a military strength that is second to no other nation. I meet the argument that military strength leads to war.
I think that is a fallacy which has been thoroughly exposed during the past 30 years. We were weak in the months just preceding World War I, and we were drawn into the war partly because we were weak. We had the smallest standing army in the world, 135,000 men, and little equipment just prior to World War II, and we were attacked. We have reason to believe that had we been powerful in 1917, and on December 7, 1941, neither Germany nor Japan would have attacked us. A negotiated settlement might well have resulted in place of the world's most terrible wars.
Another objection some of my friends raise is that the military life is undemocratic, and this is brought up specifically as an argument against universal training.
Let us admit much of the truth of that observation. We should note, however, that the armed services lack democracy in the same way that a fire department lacks democracy during a major fire, while the chief bawls out his orders to his lieutenants. All must work as a unit to be effective, and the same with a police department. Indeed, the same is true of industry, and to some extent of the church itself. In any situation where one man issues orders which multitudes of others must obey, there is a necessary surrender of a measure of democracy. A parallel question is raised concerning the manner of securing draftees. Certainly this is upon as democratic a basis as possible. There is no ruling class exempt, while a slave class bears the hazards of battle. All walks and stations of life are summoned into the service as needed. It is also well to note in passing that the armed services offer opportunity for advancement in rank on a democratic merit basis. Many of our top military leaders started their careers as privates.
Thank you, Chaplain Pollock. Here is another question. Do you think that preparedness with strong security forces necessarily leads to militarism?
As with many other words we use, militarism calls for clarification. In the sense of Prussianism, I think the danger is slight in this country. By far, the majority of men, some of them serving 6 or more years in the service, have come out glad the whole thing is over and prouder than ever of American democracy. Mighty few have come out little Napoleons. My observation is that Army service encourages love for and appreciation of democracy. Concerning universal training, let us note that discipline, respect for authority, the ability to receive and give orders, the knowledge of self-preservation, and the educational advantages which make for self-improvement are factors worthy of sober, honest thought.
Chaplain Pollock, I hope that if I have a son, that I can give him just the sort of training that you describe. I think he will be a better and more substantial citizen as a result. Many of us with families would do that without government aid if it were possible. Which brings me to another question. Military strength costs a lot of the taxpayers' money. The armed services last year had appropriations of more than $14 billions. Next year, it may exceed $15 billions. I have to agree with our critics that it is a lot of money.
Well, when you pay your insurance bills each year, they must seem a sizable chunk out of your budget also. But would you reduce your premiums and the amount of your policies?
Not on your life.
Well, let us look at the costs of war. At one time in World War II, the United States' daily expenditures reached into the hundreds of millions. The financial and property loss to this country alone for World War II was something like $500 billion. And that does not take into account the lives of our gallant young men and women who were sacrificed for our victory. Do you realize that we are spending some $7 billion annually to take care of the veterans of World War II? Do our citizens who question the cost of preparedness know that we are going to continue to pay on our World War II debt for some years to come at the rate of $10 billion annually and more? Those are some of the costs of war to this nation, and we won the war. What do you think it would cost us to lose a war? Captain Parisi, I think every citizen can answer that objection for himself.
Chaplain, I hope it no longer is a question. But here is one you may find tough. One of my neighbors told me only this morning that he saw no reason for any large defense forces, that the atomic bomb and germ warfare had made such large forces obsolete.
I am no tactical man, so like many ministers, I would like to approach this from the standpoint of common sense only. If we had a monopoly on the atomic bomb, that would be one thing. But because other nations are certain to find the atomic secret if they have not already, and because they already know the means of germ warfare, there is more need than ever to have large forces in a nationwide organization in order to prevent a total national collapse in the event of an attack of this sort. No, Captain, we cannot rest our security on that basis. Rather, it is a greater challenge than ever before to our national ingenuity to be ready to meet any situation.
But where does the United Nations organizations come into the picture?
That is what we don't know. And that goes for the people who are running the United Nations.
But some of the opposition to our program is based on the claim that it is inconsistent with our membership in the United Nations.
A United Nations organization with the effective power to prevent war is an ideal which we may not reach for many, many years. At present, it is an organization without the power to prevent war. The most powerful nations in the world still have the power through the veto to protect themselves from any consequences of their own violations. The United Nations at present is powerless to take action against a major aggressor nation. We as a people can regret that these are the circumstances under which we debate the issue of preparedness. We believe in the United Nations and hope and pray for its ultimate success. But now, right now, we cannot say, we have the United Nations. Let us do without our armed forces.
We have had experience with international organizations too, Chaplain. The League of Nations could not avert World War II.
That is right. But let us not give our friends and neighbors the false impression that we have no faith in the United Nations. We as individual citizens, and as a nation, are supporting the United Nations to the utmost of our strength and being. We in our churches pray for the United Nations in the name of all the people of the world. But what we in the Reserve Officers Association believe is that we must not, in blind and perhaps misguided faith, sacrifice our national security to the United Nations in its undeveloped, unproved circumstances.
I certainly agree with you there, Chaplain Pollock. And there is one other point that I wish to clear up. These questions that we have raised, and which I think you have rather substantially answered, are in the minds of many of our citizens. But do you think that a majority of our citizens oppose or question preparedness?
On the contrary, the overwhelming majority of our people favor it in principle. Many citizens' polls have shown that, and we must continue talking about national security, and best of all, doing something about it. That means all of our people.
That especially means our reserve officers, many of whom have virtually dropped out of the picture since the end of the war and their release from active duty.
By all means, the reserve officers to whom our citizens must continue to look for leadership in these matters must continually bestir themselves. We should have 100% of their participation in our organization and in the training program it is seeking.
We have less than that now, Chaplain. I hope that this broadcast will inspire some of those who have been too busy to get in touch with their fellow officers and again become active members of the Reserve Officers Association.
Thank you, Captain Parisi, and thank you, Dr. Pollock. Now we bring to our microphone Mr. Ross Anderson, Acting Manager of the Kalamazoo Chamber of Commerce, to tell us about the Democracy Works Here program. Mr. Anderson.
The Democracy Works Here program is being sponsored by the National Retail Dry Goods Association, the Saturday Evening Post, and some 200,000 retail stores throughout these United States. The Merchants Bureau of the Kalamazoo Chamber of Commerce is one of these sponsoring groups. Now here is your Kalamazoo retailer's thought on this program. The retail store is the perfect symbol of the fruits of our free economy. It is at the retail store that the comforts and conveniences characteristic of the American way of living are placed at the fingertips of the whole people. The results of our labor, or the wealth of desirable things displayed in the store, offers dramatic proof of the bountifulness of American production. Stores supply the material things for which people work. A majority of the goods produced in America depend on the retail stores for their final market. The Democracy Works Here program is an invitation to the public to look at retailing more closely and to consider its importance in this land of ours. It is a campaign to remind Americans of the infinite blessings of a democracy, as typified by their free choice of goods in retail stores. Without this free choice of goods, or without a free exchange of goods, we cannot have a free people. Yours is the right to pick and choose. For example, nowhere in America is the beautiful bounty better displayed than in the shopping center of Kalamazoo. Our streets are the crossroads of plenty in this land, and every store and every business on these streets is a living symbol of plenty and of democracy. Your local merchant doesn't just sell things to you, he buys things for you. It is his job to venture out into the great markets and production centers of America and bring back the goods you are going to want, in the particular size or shape or color or model you are going to like. And he must be ready to fill your needs and fancies at the exact moment you want them filled, or he fails. And in the long run, even the giant manufacturer half a continent away must please you, or he fails. In America, you are the boss. That's the way our democracy works, and every store across this land retails democracy. Your Kalamazoo stores represent a small but very important segment of this democracy. Take notice of the democracy working in Kalamazoo. It's here. Recognize it and count the blessings you have today, and work with a will toward the even greater blessings of tomorrow as they arrive. You'll see them displayed for your pleasure in the shops along the streets of Kalamazoo. Yours is the right to pick and choose. That's America, and that's Kalamazoo.